When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Thanks for having me, guys.
I know it's pretty busy.
Yeah, it's a bit busy.
They've got
time.
You on the tour.
I'm on the tour. I am on the tour.
Where you answer the same question over and,
over and over again.
Yes, yeah. We're not going to ask you any of those questions.
I know. That's why we're here.
That's
although whatever you ask me, I'm terrified that I won't have much to say because.
Well, no, but that's the other. It's like that's. Yeah,
that's why I quit therapy.
This is. I like to think I'm a fairly competent writer of some note. I have yet to figure out in any of the emails how to get across. Like, the more nervous you are about coming on, the more excited we are to have you. But what I no, only because we don't want someone who's going to come here and sort of
right
just run through the pantheon and all the
oh,
ways
right.
you're supposed to. You know,
right,
it's like
right.
we want you to like I want you to come in with wrong movies
right.
and bad opinions about them. You know that we haven't because it's. But there was a oh god, I went to see someone. I want. Are we recording?
We're always recording.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Yeah, I won't say. I went. To, I went
fans,
to see.
The fans like it.
There was a filmmaker I went to see at the Skirball Center several years ago who was introducing one of his favorite movies. But he sat and talked about. He had a sort of top 10 list of favorite films, and everyone was there. It's a really good
right.
filmmaker, and we're all sort of ooh. And it was it was Citizen Kane and Seven Samurai.
It wasn't adventurous,
right? Yeah.
And it was all just you're sitting there like I could finish this list without you. Here, I
right,
like.
Right.
Where's the part that?
Yeah, but
if he said
he liked Exorcist 2,
yeah,
then at least you have a discussion.
Exactly. Right. Now I'm going. Oh, that's interesting because I love your work, and that is the worst movie
so,
ever made.
So not
the worst movie ever made.
Well, it is according to.
Isn't there a difference though? I mean, isn't there a difference from people who bring in like I made the mistake probably of overly investing in the actual films that made a difference in my life,
uh-huh.
which are not cool. Interesting films that, is there not a difference between films people want to have formed them and actually films that maybe
well, we don't really have a choice, do we?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's the thing. It's
right.
like, I don't want to know the movies you think they're going to,
Right. Yeah.
Because I'm very, I go back to Citizen Kane every few years because you have to, but I mean, it bores me senseless and, Touch of Evil, just, I could watch that 1,000 times and never get over how happy it makes me.
Right.
And
right.
it's, Lesser Wells. And I know that's, a flaw, I suppose, in the eyes of, but it also informs sort of who I am and what I'm interested
Absolutely.
In. And
yeah.
that's sort of the point of this is to get to like, what makes you tick in terms of movies.
Right. right.
So,
I have a lot of negative examples too. Right?
That's fine.
I have things that, that I saw that and I was like, what? No.
Yes.
Yeah,
oh,
right?
No, but that's great. Yeah, we kept trying. Joe thinks it's too negative. I have a guest who wants to come on and talk about 10 movies he hates. And how they, because to me, it's like, that's the thing where you go.
But negativity is in now, so it's really.
That's, well, Dan, I think Dan Waters told the story on the show. His brother, Mark, who's a
right.
big director, was visiting Dan on the set of Adventures of Ford Fairlane. And he was in, I want to say, medical school at the time. And he looked around and he went, wait a minute, this is directing? And got a day FI and now he makes it's just like watching someone make a terrible movie made him realize
watching your brother made him
Dad didn't direct that,
wait, anybody can
it was Randy Harlan but,
oh I see okay
this is The Movies That Made Me with your hosts Josh Olson
and Joe Dante.
Let me do. We'll do our. We are our ostensible introduction. We're here with. I'm very excited, by the way.
I can tell.
Yeah, no, the writer of Bombshell here, Charles Randolph, who's also the Academy Award winning. Correct. Yes.
Correct. Yes.
Did you bring your Oscar?
I don't travel with it. I live in New York, so it's a little hard
getting into costumes.
He did The Big Short, so he keeps doing these sort of cheerful movies with these kind of upbeat messages
exactly.
for the world.
Exactly.
Bombshell is coming out very soon.
Mm-hmm.
I have no, we're terrible at the plug thing. Where Ashley, when's it?
The 13th, I think, New York, LA, and the 20th, why?
fantastic. And it stars a bunch of, I wrote down their names, these actresses, Nicole Kidman, Charlize Theron, and Margot Robbie. So they're kind of breaking in
these newcomers.
Well, it's important, I think, to give young people a chance.
Absolutely. Yes.
And then also others, they've been around a while, but you surely do not know. Lithgow, a guy named Jonathan Lithgow.
Yes. Yes. I hear he plays Roger Ailes.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
That's going to be fun.
Yeah.
We're very much looking forward to that. But
we're not going
to
talk about it.
We're
going to talk about the fact that it exists.
Yes.
And the fact that it's going to open.
That's right.
And then people should go see it.
That's correct.
And that's what.
Although also it may have opened by the time you hear this.
Oh, that's true.
The joys of podcasts. And of course, you may be listening to this 5 years from now too.
Right. Well, you hope.
Yeah, absolutely. But anyway, Charles, thank you so much for coming in. And again, I really mean it. It's like your first email. It's always a good sign when they say they're intimidated because, it means they're going to have something interesting to say.
I think it's more your legend really.
I'm not the one who's seen every movie ever made. So, but yeah, so you came in, you want to talk about, you want to tell me to describe your theme for us, if you will.
I'm always interested in how you can make politics or a political component of a film entertaining and entertaining political. So I'm interested in when those things, and all my films kind of have this place where they overlap. Right. And so I'll probably end up talking about those kinds of things. Although a lot of it's just things that have, affected me and my background. And, it's funny when you try and think of your life biographically in terms of the films that have mattered, I'm not sure that they have a very clear through line always.
Life doesn't.
Life does not. But that through line works a little bit in the sense that I was the son of missionaries. I grew up abroad for much of my life. I moved back to the States in primary school. So moved back to the Dallas-Fort Worth suburbs. So mostly, after a bit of moving around. And so, my exposure to popular culture, that suburban standard, I'm born in 1963, so that suburban standard 1970s adolescence, where, Sunday night is the NBC movie Mystery Wheel and then Charlie's Angels, and then maybe you can get to, some movie after that, which some programmer somewhere has, created a rotation of films that that you can see. That was all we had.
Really? You didn't go out to movies a lot?
We did not. My parents would take us, we got to see some of the classics, Pink Panther movies until they got a little too sexual. but there was a lot of resistance. My parents had left the States in the 60s to go to Oman and Beirut and then Greece. And then when they came back, they were a little freaked out by how far the culture had progressed.
Oh, really? Okay.
And so we were allowed television if they weren't around, but movies were a harder thing. And even then, the movies we would be allowed, not surprisingly, I'm sure you'll hear this from other people who grew up religious, Hitchcock was allowed.
Really?
Yeah. And partly because of Hitchcock's native Catholic, sensibility, right? Yeah. And the sort of severe moralism of some of what he does. But the first one I would start with is North by Northwest, because that was a film that the kind of film we were allowed.
I'm an advertising man, not a red herring. I've got a job, a secretary, a mother, two ex-wives, and several bartenders dependent upon me. And I don't intend to disappoint them all by getting myself slightly killed.
You can't fight it, Gary. Someone's out to get you by violence or by abduction. They'll even frame you for murder. So run for your life. Search for a man who doesn't exist. A secret nobody knows. And start a love affair in an upper berth.
Hello there.
Tell me, why are you so good to me?
Shall I climb up and tell you why?
A train may be an old-fashioned way to make a getaway. But who wants to get away from an exquisite, inquisitive blonde?
How do I know you aren't a
murderer? You don't.
Eva Marie Saint seems to enjoy Carrie's romantic performance, but her companion, James Mason, has other ideas. Ask him, Carrie.
Apparently, the only performance that'll satisfy you is when I play dead.
In your very next role, you'll be quite convincing, I assure you.
One surprise after another. Adventurous Carrie, romanced by the kind of blonde that gets into a man's blood, even if she has to shoot her way in.
And it had that thing of that 50s thing of good people pretending to be bad,
right?
Which allowed you to feel the naughtiness, but also know they were good. And that appealed to, obviously, to my world. So I remember that, you know, the thrill of her, you know, Marie Saint sort of pretending to seduce him, and you think it's real, but then it's not. She's actually this noble agent for the government, that kind of thing, right?
Yeah. You know? When did you, I couldn't answer this question, but when did it occur to you? And I wonder if with your background, if it was either later or sooner than someone like me who was raised just in filth and godlessness and all this stuff. At what point did you realize how dirty Hitchcock films were? I mean,
you know, I think in college you can kind of see, right? You can start to feel the it's too strong to say internal creep, but you can sort of you can sort of feel the older guy sort of there, you know, sort of, you know, yeah, scoping things out.
Yes.
Yeah, a little bit. So, but you know, those films we were allowed, and we finally got a VHS machine. I think probably the first 20 films my family had were Hitchcock films, right? And so that gave me a love of political thrillers.
That one is so good. I know you love that, right?
That's an assignment. It's a classic piece of screenwriting.
I can watch it anytime.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It parts out really beautifully. Like, it's one of those you can watch little segments of in just very satisfying way.
Well, most of his movies are like that. I mean, you click them on and you go, oh yeah, that scene.
Yeah.
You know, oh, this is the part where they're iconic. You know?
Yeah. But I mean, I've shown it to, kids, like teenagers. In fact, my niece and nephew were out last year and we went to the cemetery because it was showing there. And, you know, they're 19 and 21 and they were riveted in a way that a lot of movies from that era just don't click with, you know, kids.
Right.
Understandably.
Yeah.
Even Psycho doesn't quite work the way North by Northwest does, I think, for a modern audience.
That's why they remade it.
Yeah, exactly. Thank God they did.
And you know what's also is the look of it's fantastic, right?
Yeah.
You know, oh, that God, was it VistaVision, is that what they called it, right?
Yeah.
And just the production design, that Van Damme house that they built over here, you know, in Culver City, even to this day. I mean, I prefer to any Frank Lloyd Wright house, even though it's based on those houses. I mean, it's cantilevered out there at that weird angle, which would never exist in real life.
Right.
You know, the spatial relations in that living room are fantastic. You know, you think, God, that's a house I want to have. I want to live in. You know,
and it's right next to Mount Rushmore.
Exactly. And it's right. Yeah, exactly.
And it's got an airfield.
It's got an airfield. Yeah. Exactly. And it's got an airfield. And and then of course,
it's like candy.
It is. And his suit. I mean, how many costume designers have just gone in and said, "We're doing Cary Grant's suit." All right.
But I feel like that was his. That may be the first time it occurred to me that, like, you know, adults who do adult jobs could actually be cool.
Right.
You know, because he's just he's an advertiser.
Yeah, music. right. Yeah.
And yet
he goes on this adventure.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. No, so that's always been a favorite, you know. It's a weird one in a sense that, I mean, it was at its time, it was sort of considered to be a little bit of Hitchcock parroting himself.
Right.
But in a way, that's what I feel like gives it legs in some ways. It has this quality of being a Reader's Digest version of Hitchcock's best tropes, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and they you know, the action sequences are kind of nuts, you know, but they work, right?
Yeah.
They're I mean, conceptually, you're like, how are you going to pull that off? But
right.
My God, he pulls
it
off.
And why is the plane out there? Is that they can't come up with a better way to kill this guy than lure him out in the middle of nowhere and attack him with a biplane?
Yeah, you're going to stop the tanker truck and the plane's going to hit it? Okay. Yeah, I'm going to stand in front of the tanker truck and let
him. He was having fun. I mean, it seems like he was having fun. No, did he enjoy that process?
I think he had a wonderful time.
Because that one just seems like, he does not seem unhappy.
And he was riding high. He had his TV show. He was the most, probably the best recognized film director in the world. Because he merchandised himself into this icon.
Yeah. To the detriment of the rest of us, the rest of the business.
To the detriment of William Castle.
So that's a film that sort of, you know, communicated to me the magic of filmmaking.
Yeah.
I mean, how I could transport you to a different identity, an identity you wholly wanted to occupy. Right. So, when I graduated college, I left the country to go be James Bond for Jesus. I went off to Eastern Europe. This is the 80s, and I worked for a group to smuggle Bibles into Eastern Europe.
Oh, wow.
And, print the Gospel of Mark on really thin paper and get a fan and pull the bed out and put it down and, smuggle it in.
Oh, wow.
Right, and part of that was informed just by that adolescent life of Hitchcock films.
So you actually had a life before you came to movies.
I did. I didn't write my first screenplay. I want to say 34, maybe 33. Yeah. Yeah. So I went off and I did that, and I was in a place called Olomouc, which is in Slovakia, when I met the Time Magazine bureau chief, and then went off and did some stuff from them as a sort of a freelance stringer consultant for a few months, and then went to graduate school. So, yeah, that's...
And what made you decide film?
Well, I went back to Europe and I was a professor. I taught cultural studies, which was had a toe in film at the time. And I would do different sort of cultural fields every year. So I came out here to do feature film one year. I think the previous year I'd done documentaries. And the year before that I'd done maybe museum spaces. I can't remember. And anyway, so I was going to do a whole thing on, film theory and whatnot. And I taught a course in the summers with Drew Casper at USC. Mm-hmm. And we taught the course on Tuesday. And then Thursday we would interview various writers in various genres at the Guild. And I guess I was interviewing the Farrelly brothers, or maybe met somebody who knew the Farrelly brothers, maybe Sharpie, their guy back in the day, or Bradley, can't remember. And, he said, "Oh, write something for us." So I sat down that summer and wrote a script. Oh. And I knew someone at CAA, and they agreed to represent me, and I was sort of off to the races. It was an homage to John Waters called Fat, F-A-T, that never got made. Probably should be buried in a vault now somewhere, since it's...
As should all first people.
Exactly. Exactly. So my entrance, my entrance is pretty easy. I set up a pitch on the basis of that. The life of David Gale came out of that, Right. So that first 3 or 4 months in the film business. Yeah. So
cool.
That's that. Yeah. But when I was in Eastern Europe, obviously I spent a lot of time traveling. So I'm a huge fan, particularly tonally, of the Czech New Wave, right? And so I think Loves of a Blonde is probably my favorite film.
Oh, wow, okay.
I don't know if you guys remember it well. Sure. But just his ability, because he's in this weird space of, and all of them were, of not being able to speak freely, right? Mm-hmm. But having so much to say, right? It creates this delicious tension where you feel everything is so laden with meaning. And then to take that and find comedic registers of doing that, it's just, it's just phenomenal, right? So I love that. And I loved also the tropes they would use, some of the methods they would use.
You've seen Daisies?
I have. Love Daisies.
Remarkable movie.
Remarkable movie, yeah.
Almost unknown.
Yeah. Why someone's not.
Vera Chitlova.
Yeah. How did you say her last name?
Chitlova.
Chitlova.
But I could be doing it wrong. Chitlova,
yeah. I know her name. I don't know the film.
It's Booksmart. Set in 1965, I think, and it's these two women who are just, it's just about the pleasure of being friends, right? Mm-hmm. In their sort of screwed up world. And it just, you're hard put to name a film that takes more liberties with the film form. Yeah. I like to do crafts and collages, and the film just starts to get cut up into pieces. It'll go back and forth between black and white and color. It's just a phenomenal.
It's really an amazing, liberating movie to watch.
Oh, okay. Oh, here it is. Hey, on Blu-ray. Am I buying it?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. Definitely. All right. Yeah, yeah. That's a definite buy, yeah, for sure.
Some people get paid to do shows. I end up like...
And we just get to kick
the show breaks companies.
Wait, Criterion doesn't have some special deal with you? You just ring them up and
they
deliver?
They should.
Maybe they will.
Well,
in our next incarnation.
That day will come.
That's what you need. My wife is one of the leads of Dead Men, Jarmusch's movie, right? Mili Abital. And so she did her, when they re-released it, she did some little recording for them. So they took us up to New York to their office, and they bring you into their room.
The closet.
The closet.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
And they say, take a few things. Cut to us walking out. With as many things we could hold. But that closet is probably the sexiest space in New York City. It's just, I fantasize about that space.
Hey, we had Bill Hader on, and I kept waiting for him to thank us by getting us in there. And nothing.
Oh, man.
I'll have to have him on again and excoriate him.
Ungrateful bastard. Yeah.
Chastise him.
All the exposure we gave him. I just ordered daisies.
It's fantastic. It's just the level of play and it's the thing I'm interested in, and that the political metaphor takes a while to emerge, but when you get it, it's sort of profound, right? It's a time of pretty, it's just before Prague Spring, so things are getting better, but mm-hmm. it is a period of economic deprivation in that world, which takes the form of the limited availability of foodstuffs, basically, right? Like, just getting anything but a certain kind of bread, right, a certain kind of sausage is next to impossible. So it's a movie about these two women who go on dates basically to eat, right? And it culminates in essentially they find this feast that's laid out for these people, and they just go crazy. It's these two young women having a bacchanalia of just decadent food fight and drinking everything and tasting everything. And it goes on and on and on and on. But it was, you know, in its time, it was pretty profound, you know, message. Much more subtle than some of the other Czech New Wave films. I'm trying to think of, is it Jan Nemec's film? Is it the party and its guests?
Yes.
The dinner party and its guests?
The
report on the party and its guests, right? By the way, I always picture all those great posters. Whoever did posters in Czechoslovakia in that day is a true genius. They are phenomenal posters. But anyway, that particular movie has, you know, is quite heavy in its metaphor. It's about, you know, these thugs who recruit these people on an outing into a dinner party. They're not allowed to leave. And that's sort of a metaphor for the state. Like, we give you all this stuff. Mm-hmm. You get to drink, you get to eat, but you have to do what we say. And it just sort of goes crazy from there. But it's pretty heavy-handed throughout. Whereas Daisy's just, it has a lovely, you know, it sort of sneaks up on you because of their chaos, you know, and just their joy at being young and having fun, which was unusual in films, particularly the Polish films of that era, you know. So, but Milos, who I had a chance to work with a little bit right before he died, he was going to direct something I wrote and got to spend some time with. His particular sensibility is truly remarkable.
When he first came over here and did Taking Off, which is a wonderful film that is very difficult to see because of music rights, because it's filled with all these young New York teenage girls who are at an audition and they're all doing their own compositions and they're spotted all throughout the picture. One of whom is Carly Simon and one of whom is Kathy Bates. Kathy Bates,
right,
another named Bobo Bates.
Wow.
That's right, Bobo Bates.
It's about a girl who leaves the parents and goes to New York, and the parents are Buck Henry and Lynn Carlisle, and they have to come and find her in New York, and they meet all these other parents who are also looking for their lost kids in 1971. And it was a Universal picture, and it opened to a lot of acclaim, and then it sort of disappeared, and now it's almost impossible to find.
Is it really?
It's never screened.
An upcoming video release recently,
it would certainly be nice if there was.
Yeah.
But there is a good copy video release out on some label that I can't remember, but which I have, which is the only one that I've ever seen that's half decent. But it's really worth tracking down because it's an excellent picture.
And it shows up in repertory theaters from time to time. I saw it in the Egyptian,
I've never seen it. Yeah.
It's definitely worth seeing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he was, I know Scott and Larry, Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski, who are friends of the show, former guests. They worked with him, Man in the Moon.
Sure.
And just, I know that was a just profoundly great experience for them. And they loved him.
Yeah. Yeah. He had this line, I can't remember exactly what it was, but something about, you know, stupid government for the screenwriter. Oh, he's a gift. You know, and so that feeling for the absurdities of everyday life, you know, as you try and build the universal out of the specific is something that I think about a lot.
I want to go down that rabbit hole with you just for a minute, sure. Just because as here we both sit, screenwriters, with I would argue, probably agree, one of the stupider governments we've ever had.
Right.
I feel like we've reached a point now where it is so stupid that it almost
smart.
Yeah.
No, but it transcends the ability to
exhaust parody.
Well, parody is dead.
Yeah.
And then just to simple things too. I often I think about now the portrayal of presidents in just kind of dopey stuff. You know, imagine you know, you have a show like 24 where your president is either sort of generic president man or woman, or a specific kind of, you know, didn't they do one where he's a villain who's murdered his vice president or some such, but they're all still these very kind of buttoned down. But now you can't do any of those, and you can't do Trump because he's so specific.
Right, right.
So it's sort of like what kind of cartoon clown
It's the Jerry Springer presidency, you know. Yeah. I mean, you have to be able to hire that kind of larger than life, you know, carny showman.
Right. But I mean, if you were making, what's the movie about the meteor with Morgan Freeman?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, if you were making that today and you were going to cast the generic president, what would you do?
Oh, that's funny. I hadn't thought about that. For the next decade, what are we going to do when it comes time for the token presidential?
Yeah, they can't all be comic mumblers.
Yeah.
I mean, we called the Second Civil War and we had Phil Hartman playing
that's
the president.
Right, yes.
And he was indeed Trump-like. Not as
very watered down, though.
Watered down, and obviously,
he was plausible.
Who could have imagined the depth that you would have to sink in order to be Trump?
Right.
But you know, when you think about what an amazing difference it is between the way presidents used to be portrayed in the 30s and 40s, when they would either be you'd be behind their heads, or they'd be side shot.
Right.
Or there'd be an actor who looks somewhat like the president, but they'd be dubbed by somebody who's imitating the president, almost always Roosevelt.
Right.
And there was a certain majesty to the president, a certain mystery and a certain dignity that you just didn't, you know. And now, I mean, it's Idiocracy.
Yeah.
The president in Idiocracy is very much like the president we have now.
They both have careers in professional wrestling.
Yeah.
It's confounding.
Yeah. You know, I mean, all the filmmakers I know obviously are constantly scheming to try and figure this one out. Like, what is the movie? And The Whistleblower gave a lot of people hope, I think, that, that would be a way into the story of this moment. But I don't know. I don't think so.
I don't think we quite know what the story of this moment is yet.
Yeah,
I've got
the pace, the editing pace of our lives has changed immensely.
Yeah.
You know, it used to be days and maybe even a week would go by without hearing or thinking about the president, whoever he was. Yeah. And now every 5 minutes, there's a new news cycle.
Yeah.
And it's all been ramped up to a point where there's no spaces in between. It's just constant.
We're all addicted to the news, right?
I mean, well,
as the NFL has found out, right? You know, where people have better things to do now than their traditional entertainments. And they really want it. They really want to watch the news.
But that's why I think The Big Short is a kind of a early clue to the new direction,
in the
way that it tells that story,
right?
Which is a complicated story, and many of us who are not gifted in the understanding of finance.
I couldn't conceive of a more boring one-liner,
than
the one for The Big Short. You thought, you got to be fucking kidding,
right?
But the way it's
presented, an informative film out of
it's entertaining. It surprises you all the time, and it gives you new information at a pace that you can understand, and illuminate. And the new pieces of information illuminate the old pieces of information. I mean, it's just
thank you. That's
extremely
very kind
clever.
Thank you, Joe. That's very kind coming from you, especially.
Yes,
that's
but I think that that's I think you're going to find that approach is going to have to be more ubiquitous.
Well, I'm excited for you to see Bombshell because that is the same thing in a much more known arena, right?
But with sexy time.
You know, actually, yes and no, right? I mean, that's the thing.
Sleazy
it's that thing of, you know, how can you take this world that we all think we know about and find a way in that brings you along and. You know, I'd been wanting to do something on sexual harassment for a while. Here we're talking about it. I said I wouldn't talk about it.
We'll cut it.
Anything that refers to your new movie and only talk about old movies.
Okay. Sorry. But anyway, so you know, I've been looking for something to do something and this arena was fantastic because what it allows me to do is you get to laugh at these people for a while and then you get to laugh with them. And then suddenly you're sort of with them in these rooms where this stuff is going on, and it just throws you for a loop. So it's the same dynamic, and tonally it's very similar. It's very similar to Big Show.
How did the existence of the Showtime version affect your project?
Not at all. I've never seen it.
It's fine.
I think a couple people read. I think Jay read a few of the scripts. I actually met with Jason Blum. Right before he started looking, he had just signed the book deal. He was going to start looking for a writer, and I was just about to go out and pitch Bombshell. And we talked for 30 seconds, and we knew we were going to be doing very different things because I was going to be focusing on the women, that last year, particularly the last 2 weeks of Roger's existence, and he was going to do this whole arc of who he was. But it hasn't affected us at all, I don't think. In fact, in a way, it's helped us.
Help you.
Yeah, I can see that. Sorry, but we're back.
We always digress and talk about sexual harassment.
Yeah, right. Exactly. But to go to The Big Short, I mean, obviously Big Short is informed by a couple of my other favorites, you know, 24-Hour Party People, which is just fantastic.
Now, it's been a while, and I'm a big fan, but my favorite part of what you just said was obviously. Because now I'm going, am I an idiot?
You know, I guess because Adam and I talk about that so much back 3 or 4 years ago. So I just sort of feel like this is the thing people know about it, but maybe they don't. I don't know. Certainly for me in my head, a couple years later. But 24-Hour Party People, just in its ability to play in this like daisies with a film form and just do all these crazy things, you know? I always love it when I find myself getting really emotional about something that has no rubric for me to understand why I'm being emotional about it, but I'm genuinely moved right now, and there's no reason for me to be, because there's no dog in trouble. So why am I, why am I being moved? But there's a moment in 24-Hour Party People where he's in that concert. There are 42 people in that concert, and he takes you around the room to these kids that are dancing or on stage or in the back, sort of sitting down, and he says, "That's that band. That's that band." And it's just so moving, this idea that these kids gathered together for this first punk concert, and they will go on to create this genre of music, right? And reach massive success.
Manchester, birthplace to the railways, the computer, the bouncing bomb. In 1976, if you wanted to see the most exciting bands in the world, they were on a regional show coming out of Manchester. My show. I'm Tony Wilson. June the 4th, the Sex Pistols play Manchester for the very first time. There are only 42 people in the audience. Inspired, they will go out and perform wondrous deeds. For instance, behind me are Stiff Kittens, later to become Joy Division. And finally to become New Order. That's John the Postman. He's a postman. Have you heard of the Factory Records? My label, Joy Division, New Order, Happy Mondays. We are an experiment in human nature.
What kind of music you got me bringing in?
Sort of new wave,
kind of indie.
Indian?
It's a pity you didn't sign the Smiths.
I've just seen God.
What do you look like?
You look like me.
And it's that thing, of course, that we know in films when we talk about them in the macro, which is that the arc of getting what you want is really cathartic and moving for us as an audience. But to get it in that condensed form of him just taking you through, it's both hilarious and wonderful and beautifully filmed, because it's sort of, he turns the camera to do it and you're just enjoying the concert, but also, oddly emotional.
Yeah, no, it's a great film. It's lovely, as you say, sort of very bright and colorful and constantly. I see the some of a connection in that one of the things that you did The Big Short was you managed to make this incredibly dry subject, at least to most of us.
Yeah.
You invigorated it with kind of every trick in the book, from great dramaturgy to that constant, like, I never knew what was going to happen next stylistically.
Right.
Which is a lot of fun.
It helped in that one that it had a very simple plot, which is the deal. Like, you get very good. Are they going to sell out and make all this money, given that they have such a tortured relationship to this industry? So that helped that obviously a lot. But I'm a big believer that those devices, they're hard to do because they can feel gratuitous really quickly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. You know, they have to be achieving something you can achieve by no other means.
Yeah.
Right. And if they are, they work. And if they're not, we smell it.
Or it's just a decision from the get-go that's the road you're going to go down.
Right.
It's got to feel organic.
Yeah. That too. But I think it also, you have the sense that you need that device, right? That it has some function for us that besides just that's how we're going to tell this story, there has to be something in the story, I think, that makes it work, at least for me. And 24-Hour Party People, because it's a world that most of us don't know very well.
Right.
Because it wants to speak in such elliptical terms about a whole genre of music and its history at once, it's sort of necessary. And Coogan's just fantastic.
Yeah.
he's so funny. And then another one in that simmer vein, is is Man Bites Dog.
Oh yeah.
You're right. You know,
that's come up. That's not quite in the Ed Wood. Almost every episode of Ed Wood. Man Bites Dog.
Certain titles keep reappearing.
Right. Man Bites Dog has popped up far more often
for a movie that's generally not very well known.
Yeah.
Where can you? Is it Criterion too?
There's a Criterion. I don't know if it's Blu-ray yet, but there's definitely.
You can. What I love about it is, for those of you who don't know, it's a movie obviously about. Obviously, it's a movie about this film crew following around a killer, and the film starts to turn on the film crew and on us as viewers, and we become complicit. And there's a moment late in the film where there's a relatively brutal rape, and leads to a murder, and it's just one of those films that, you know, in that mockumentary idiom, the last thing you expect to do is to be so true to its convictions and turn on us.
Yeah.
But it does. And it
defines the word disturbing.
Yes, yeah. it really does. Yeah, it really does.
I feel you're not, I can't remember, you hate it, right?
No, I don't hate it.
No.
No, I think the story I may have told was that I was making a movie at the studio, and the guy who was in charge of the movie had this giant three sheet in his office for Man Bites Dog, which is the three sheet is the guy firing the gun down at the bottom of the picture. And then at the bottom, there's blood coming up and a baby rattle.
Okay.
And a teething ring.
Oh God.
And this guy's got this in his office, and I'm making a cartoon comedy for this guy.
Right.
And surprise, surprise, he was a pain in the ass through the entire experience.
Joe now associates this movie with the assholes.
I'm afraid I do. It's not their fault, but it's just, it's just got
all right, guys, good to see you.
Bad vibes.
That would be his concern. Yeah. Yeah. I can see. Although, what do you do? Do you have should you have sort of rotating posters depending on the project you're meeting?
Listen, if I had the ability to have rotating posters in my office, I would definitely have rotating posters.
You can. I do at home. You get those.
Who picks? Oh, you don't.
Yeah,
you don't lift them off the wall.
The frames pop out.
Oh, I see.
They're screwed to the wall and you slap them in and they change with the seasons. It was just Halloween. They had some great horror films.
Really? Wow.
But because I was leaving. I just went to Korea for a few days, and my wife, who's not a horror fan, was going to be alone in the house for several days. I took down the horror films just so she wouldn't have to. What did I put up? Juggernaut and Freebie and the Bean.
Richard Lester.
What
does that tell us about your relationship? That those are the two you chose for your wife while you were gone.
Oh, she loves 70s kind of caper films.
It was just
horror films are not her.
Right. But not my thing either. It's to go a little bit back. When I moved back to the States as a kid, and I went into seventh grade, we were rewarded for something that the school had done in the first couple weeks of school, as a matter of fact. With a screening for the seventh graders of Tales of the Crypt.
Oh.
Which is a pretty damn dark movie to screen for seventh graders, right? And I had never seen a horror film in my life.
Really?
Never.
Did you know it was based on a comic book?
I did not at the time, do now. And I was devastated.
There's some pretty dark stuff.
I slept on my parents' floor for 2 weeks. I couldn't believe that and to this day, there are horror tropes that I don't want to go anywhere near. There's this base revulsion in me I don't want to see that. Don't want to think about that. And so I can get there with films like Man Bites Dog or Blue Velvet. Like you can get me to that moment where I can, but if it starts off with the promise of those narratives,
takes all kinds.
Yeah. It does. I'm trying to find. I can't remember if it's that or I can't pull it up. My trailers from Hell bio. I can't remember. Does it say I was the only second grader to see? I can't remember if it was House That Dripped Blood.
No, it was House That Dripped Blood.
I remember
his bio.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I had a very sheltered upbringing.
Right? Yeah,
so I was probably 11. But and I've probably made the reverse. My son at 10's favorite movie was Saving Private Ryan. So I've probably overcorrected in making sure that he was exposed to.
That's weird. Yeah. I don't mean, I'm like, for a 10-year-old to enjoy that film seems.
He's a huge World War II buff.
Really? Okay.
Massive. I mean, he can talk 10? To you at length. Well, he's 12 now, but he can talk to you at length about the Stutka and how the horn worked and when the tone he would make when it was diving. I mean, he'll get into it with you.
We should. He should come on and do his 10 favorite horror films.
It would be much more entertaining than me. A, and B, he can actually say something about horror films.
War films. Like, have him come.
Oh, war films. Yes.
That would be fun.
Yeah. You know, a good one for young, they're actually.
What's a good war film for the kids?
Yeah. I heard myself going there. Like, yeah, don't do that.
Schindler's List.
No, Dunkirk.
Kids love that stuff.
Yeah, Dunkirk is actually for adolescents a pretty good film, right?
Okay.
It's, you know, it's not too bloody, and you know,
yeah, that's true.
And it has a certain poetry too, you know, to where it goes, and a certain heroism. Yeah, yeah.
You think
Dunkirk?
Yeah,
the new one.
Yeah,
as opposed to the old one.
Oh yeah, the old one. Yeah, new one's fun.
Yeah, it's fine.
You're damning with some faint praise right now, guys.
wasn't my favorite of his films,
right?
But,
yeah.
It's fine.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
What else? Yeah, what's your next?
You know, I still think Election's a gem of a movie.
If you're one of the millions of Americans who still believes that honesty, integrity, and fidelity are the cornerstones of our democracy, we suggest you wait for another preview before getting your popcorn. In the nation's capital, a new leader has found a place in the halls of power. But her story began in the halls of high school.
We'll move on now to the presidential race with three candidates running. The first is Tracy Flick.
One thing that's important to know about me is that I'm an only child. My mom is really devoted to me. She likes to write letters to successful women like Elizabeth Dole and Connie Chung and ask them what advice do they have for me, Tracy, her daughter.
The next candidate for student body president is Paul Metzler.
I just don't think somebody would do something like that on purpose.
I think you did it.
And if you want to keep questioning me like this, I won't continue without my attorney present. I do not often speak with you and ask for things, but now I really must insist that you help me win the election tomorrow, because I deserve it and Paul Metzler doesn't, as you well know.
The final candidate, sophomore Tammy Metzler.
I'm attracted to the person. It's just that all the people I've ever been attracted to happen to be girls.
You should stop her. She's not qualified.
We can't both run, can we? I mean, we're brother and sister, can we?
Tracy and I are totally in love.
In love?
Yeah.
So is this a moral situation or an ethical situation?
When I win the presidency, that means you and I are going to be spending a lot of time together.
Cast your vote for Tracy Flick next week. You won't just be voting for me.
You suck!
You'll be voting for yourself.
Who knew how high she would climb in life? I had to stop her.
Excuse me! Will you please be quiet?
Now,
just in his ability to take that world, and you know, I love the suburbs, obviously, as you guys do too, and just to immerse us in the sights and sounds and the day to day like rhythms of it. Like I think of that scene where Matthew Broderick comes home. It's like an establishing shot, even, which is kind of not something I think that he would normally do. And like he pulls in and he goes in the kitchen and he gets the beer, and it's just like so patient. And we're and he hears a baby in the next room, right? And he realizes it's the baby of the woman he's been trying to have an affair with. So he knows, oh, this. And we watch him creep down that hall, and he looks around the corner, and there are both women staring at him. Little cups of tea,
yes.
You know, one of them holding the child, right? Having clearly had the most ruthless heart to heart of their lives. And he says, okay.
Yeah.
that's the only dialogue in that scene. And he's out in the driveway, and you know, we crane up, you know, like, you are so screwed, buddy. Your life is over. And just, you know, I mean, his ability, Alexander Payne's ability to do that, just that, to feel that, because all that's authentic, right? The way you drop your bag, the way you pick up a beer, like you have these habits of moving in, and it just, I don't know.
The way everything is perfectly normal until the moment where it is just not shattered. That's an amazing film. I hadn't seen it for several years. I remember seeing it a bunch of times in the first year or two when it came out. And you just sort of, every time I saw it, I'd forgotten. And then it recently came out on, I guess, Criterion, did a Blu-ray, right? And I was like, great, I haven't watched it in years. And it was that same thing. I was like, I knew it's good. You just forget how great it is, how every scene just delivers on that kind of, there's a creepiness and an ick and there's a sympathy for every character, yet an ability to skewer every one of them on a pin and just make them wiggle until they bleed out.
And it has a sort of subtext of gender politics that's never addressed, but informs everything, like that scene, a little bit like Quentin's movie. I mean, Once Upon a Time in America has that same thing. There's a whole gender politics thing running throughout, critique of woke culture running, that's sort of interesting there, And there's this election has that quality too of, that's pretty engaging, pretty fascinating.
Well, because I remember during the election, the actual election, there were people who would hold, they would make the Hillary Clinton, Tracy Flick comparison, but positively.
As
a way of like, she's a go-getter, she's a thing. You'd be like, have you seen the film? I'm not sure I disagree with you, but I don't think that's
a... the Tracy Flick label gets thrown around a lot. And usually not in a good way.
But it's an amazing character.
Yeah, it's a great character.
And she's always, I always see her in glimmers of everything that Reese does.
Yeah, you do. But he captures something about, particularly in that section where she's looking out the bus window, and she's thinking about the kid who's running against her, and she's, imagining, how she can feel the prize slipping away. And she just has this look on her face that you almost never see on Reese's face. Never. But it is powerful. Yeah. It is super powerful. These hooded eyes and just, she's ready to knife somebody. Yeah. And it's great. Yeah.
And it works kind of in that sense of some of the things we're talking about where, again, have not seen Daisies, but the sense I got is that you can have a thoroughly wonderful time watching the film and completely miss the politics.
Yeah, you could.
And obviously, it's a movie about school politics, but the sort of overt, the way it handles actual politics is so astute.
Absolutely. And often that's the hardest thing. People love to talk about Costa Gravis's Z, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember the first time I saw it thinking, and this is a negative example, What? This is didactic as hell, right? This is real. This is torturing me right now. That's how I feel. I probably shouldn't say that. I love Costa Gravis. No. But it's just,
he's not a listener.
So. Yeah. Oh, good. Thank God. My company's called Gramsci. I have some sympathy for the world he comes from, but I just, it's hard to do that right. It's easy to tip that too far the other way, right? To do the politics in a way that's entertaining. So that's one of those that I just, I'm probably beloved at this table. I should probably just shut up now.
Fine. We love when people skewer the sacred cows.
But I mean, it's just, the minute they become overt, politics become a little bit of a problem, don't they? So it's always about finding.
Cause I tend to agree.
Yeah.
Although I think sort of a movie like, when I think political movies, I think one of my all-time favorites, again, just came out of Criterion, Matewan, John Sayles, which is very much overt in its politics and yet still works 100% fundamentally as a piece of entertainment.
Right.
Without.
But that's a hard on the sleeve.
It's also.
And it's a movie that needed to be made because of, that's a story that was never told from that angle before.
Right. No, absolutely.
And probably which most people didn't.
But it's not a film that runs up against my, and I'm often like, there's nothing I hate more than being in the choir that is being preached to.
Yeah.
And that film clearly is, and yet somehow he manages to dance above it all very artfully with.
The difficulty is always with these films is avoiding the trap of earnest passivity on the part of your characters.
That's a good, right?
Particularly if they're victims of crime. It's a real thing not to get caught in that trap of things are happening to this person,
right.
this noble person.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we often treat making, you know, I think of this because of Megyn Kelly and Gretchen Carlson, obviously, but we often treat a movie being made about you as an award Hollywood's going to give you, you know, for a good, noble choice, right? Or you survive extreme circumstances. But that's not why we make movies about you, right? We make movies about you because you have a rich and compelling internal conflict, right? You know, and if it's rich, it's something we haven't seen before. It's unusual, you know.
Those are not exactly like pure heroines either.
No, they're not.
In the fight for justice.
No, they are not. And that's what, but that's not
that's
a bug.
That's why it's interesting.
That's not, yeah, it's not a bug, yeah. It's a feature. That's what makes them interesting because, yeah. you know, they can entertain us along the way. And we can, you know, I don't know who's going to make the, you know, the Harvey Weinstein story into a movie. But what's your way in, right? Are you going to do Megan and Jody? What are their internal conflicts, right? You know, at the times. You
look starring Louis C.K.
Hey, there you go.
If you look back at, you know, if you look back at All the President's Men, you know, for its day, that's a pretty, those characters are pretty flawed, right? Right. You know, I mean, one of them's sort of, you know, they don't like each other. One of them's, you know, quietly, pretty ruthlessly ambitious. The other's, you know, neurotic and a little, you know, a little irritating. For that white shoe world of that day, they were real human beings, right? And that's right. always difficult to do. When it comes to issues around which there is any cultural delicacy at all.
Well, that also, I have an increasing gripe with that film in that it, I wish it had done more of that actually approachable. Because every time I watch it, it is fascinating. It's a fascinating story. And I watched it about a year ago with a bunch of people who, some of whom were not sort of relics of that era.
Right.
I mean, I came of age during that. I had the Watergate coloring book, you know.
Oh, did you really?
I'm the guy sitting there watching the movie going, how the fuck is B.B. Rebozo not in this movie? How do you do this story without B.B. Rebozo? And I kept wondering, like, if you were not intimately familiar with this story, would this movie work for you? And I don't know. But I do know that what happened is it had such a huge impact on the world of journalism. Where there's been this sort of shift where, you know, all these, you know, journalists were primarily before that, a great many of them, they were these kind of, you know, I don't remember, just like these working class guys. It was kind of it was a bit of a shameful job, you
right,
know?
Yeah.
And that made them into these kind of heroes. And you all of a sudden got this influx of all these kind of white collar Ivy League guys who wanted to get into journalism. And of course, the problem with that is all those guys go to school with the people they're theoretically reporting on.
Absolutely,
And cut to decades later and, you know, they're all palling around with members of the Trump administration writing about them at the same time.
Yeah.
And I do blame that movie for some of that. I blame the response to that movie.
Right.
But I feel like if they had gone deeper into sort of character flaws in them and things, there might have been it would be more dramatic.
Right.
So you're saying the movie needed to have an alcoholic.
Yeah. You know, I don't know, or a wife beater. I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, something to make them a little less appealing would be.
Yeah. No, Casey Lemons wrote Harriet this year, and I keep telling her, you had the hardest job. You get stuck in the second act with Harriet, you're not giving her an affair.
Exactly.
Let's give her a little substance problem here. I mean, you know, when someone is beloved and iconic in that way, those are some serious handcuffs. Handcuffs.
No, there's a character named Bass Reeves, who's the greatest gunfighter in the Old West.
Right.
He's the most successful U.S. Marshal.
Right.
Highest rate of, you know, bringing guys in. Yeah. And he was black. He was African-American.
Right.
And I've always wanted to do his story. And the problem with his story is he was a profound, devout Christian who 99 times out of 100, the guys would find out Bass Reeves was after them. They'd give themselves up. Yeah. He'd put them in a cart. He'd ride them back. He'd read the gospel to them. By the time he got there, they were converts.
Right.
And you look at his entire happily married, you know, I'm like, you need some conflict. There's no conflict there. And what am I going to do to this amazing African-American icon to make him interesting except bring him down and make him flawed and tear it. Now I'm doing that.
No, it's tough. It's tough.
Really tough.
It's tough. Yeah. I want to ask you a question about All the President's Men. I've heard, and this may be urban legend, that Redford, you know, meets with him quite early, Woodward and Bernstein. While they're still in the story.
Right.
And that there is one scene that occurred while Redford was in the room. Have you ever heard this myth or
not?
I would love to know if this is true. Because it sort of answers a little bit of the problem, right? Because Redford is so integrated into his subjects.
Right.
This is why I never meet him. Man, the minute you meet him, they are on your shoulder.
Yeah. Mm.
So I always write without him. I figure I'll trust what's in the dominant culture narrative, right? I'll trust their news reports. I'll trust their affidavits. And then once I have a sense of the story, then I'll call them. Right. And I'll get to know them then. Because
well, that's the problem with the Manson story.
Yeah.
That's just coming out of this book. I think it's called Chaos, a journalist who was doing a piece on the 20th anniversary of the Manson murders and has now been working on it for a decade and found out all this stuff about how Bugliosi was already working with the writer of the book even
before. Oh, right, yeah.
And crafting this narrative and how much of what we know about the Manson family seems to have been made up.
That's a movie. I want that movie, right?
With the idea of like making this something I can sell as a book and then as a movie.
Yeah.
And that maybe half the shit we know about this guy is wildly inflated.
Right.
Not by a screenwriter, but by the district attorney who was looking to sell a book.
Oh, that's a great conflict though.
Like, absolutely. Yes.
That's a way in, right? You're with that writer, and he's discovering this, and what do you do? No, that's super interesting. Anyway, I would love to know if that's true about that Redford actually.
That's interesting. I don't know. Some of our listeners can elucidate for
exactly.
us.
Exactly. Now write us, but that's the conversation, I think, probably is the best of those. I'm torturing the obvious now, aren't I?
But any excuse
to talk about the conversation. Yes. Right? But if you look at that genre of political thrillers like Condor, that has the same political fervor, but it's much more subtle.
Yeah.
Right? And it is in some ways more damning. It's a more damning indictment in a way of corporate culture and wealth in this country than any of those more overt political things in some ways.
Well, because it plays no matter where.
Yeah.
Whereas, like I said, with Watergate, it's like if you don't know who Chuck Colson is, you're watching the film going, what?
Yeah.
But the conversation translates to any place and time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do they even name the company? I've seen it 400 times.
Harry is the only guy who's got a name.
I have one minor gripe with that film, and it's frustrating, and I always forget it, and every time I see it, because with all the amazing sound work that Walter Murch did and everything, they do cheat the ending. It's actually a different recording of them. He'd kill us if he had the chance.
Right.
It's not. I'm sure they played with it forever to see if they could make it work naturally, and they just couldn't, so they cheated.
Right.
Yeah. But other than that, one of the greatest movies ever made.
Yeah, and also the spotlight, putting the focus on sound, right? It's just such a lovely, I always say we learn with our eyes and we feel with our ears. In college, I had a radio show, and it was just amazing the relationship you would build with people who would listen, because they would just have such an emotional, because you're a voice, disembodied voice, reaching them in the night, and it really, they would.
Oh, they would talk radio.
Yeah, exactly.
You get a little closer
exactly
to the mic while you say that.
Exactly. Yeah. And so there's that thing of just appreciating that how his relationship to them mediated by hearing them, how emotional that is for him. It's just, it's really clever.
How old were you when you saw that? Was that like a youthful experience?
College? Yeah, I was in college. Okay. Yeah.
Because, I saw it as a child. Yeah. My dad took me to this. Yeah, I remember, but there's a weird, no, you're right, because there was something, it took me years to realize that it is that. It was the focus on sound that made that film so distinct, an emotional experience, even though I had no idea what the hell I was watching.
Right. Yeah.
But
it's the thing that Blowout missed, Although I like Blowout as a movie, but in sort of moving from Blow Up to Blowout, right? It tried to capture a little bit of that, but it gets caught in a little bit more, too much diplomacy.
There's a little too much plotting in the end.
The end of the movie doesn't make sense.
I've said this before. Every episode can't degenerate into us fighting about the greatest Brian De Palma film.
Oh, that is so not the greatest film.
I fucking love it.
Do you really?
Yeah, everything about it.
Why? It's because I bet you feel, right? I mean, it's a very emotional. That ending is kind of hard. I mean, you feel that scream. That's.
Well, I think I said this on another episode too. I had read the novelization first.
Oh, you did? Okay.
And they changed the ending. The ending of the book's a happy ending. So when they do that to you in the movie, it's even more shocking because you're. But Joe is not the big fan of that one, but.
No, not at all.
Josh has a lot of bizarre beliefs.
But conversation, clearly seminal in that way.
But Citizen Kane is a journalist movie too.
It is, and important for me because trying to convince people that writers writing about people they disagree with politically is always better than writers writing about people that we all agree with politically is kind of tough. So I've been evoking Citizen Kane a lot over the last month and a half or so. But why that, in a way, one of the reasons that film works is because the real life person forced Wells to meet him halfway. You know what I mean? And what emerges is not the guy, and not a totally fictional creation either. It's this thing that two souls have created in their conflict.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And it just works. It just works.
I don't know what it is. It never connects with me emotionally.
Oh, really?
No. Yeah. I think it's got one of the most moving endings I've ever seen in a movie.
Joe has a sled. Oh, he has one of them.
I have one of them.
Oh, you do, really?
I do.
Wow. How many were there?
I don't know, but this one is balsa wood, so I think it's the ones they burn at the end.
Okay,
so however many they just text they did. Okay, right. We got it. Right. This went back into the RKO vault. Okay. Ended up with it.
How long have you, you bought it at an auction?
No, I was making a picture at Paramount, and they were cleaning out the bowels of the studio, and which used to be RKO. That half of the studio used to be RKO. And so they were throwing things out, and there were huge dumpsters with like antiques and lamps and all this stuff, like just dumpsters. And this guy comes up to me and says, "We're going to throw this out. You think you want it?" And I said, "Yeah, I'll take that."
My God. Josh, for those of you, because it's a podcast, can't see, Josh is green. He's just green. Like every pit of him is green right now. the envy coming on from that side of the table.
Imagine?
I know, it's nuts. It's nuts, isn't it? Right. You know,
not the guy wasn't a film buff. What can I tell you?
Is there a more iconic film prop? In
no,
the
there
history?
Is not. There
I don't
is
think not.
I mean, it's insane. Yeah, I've seen this thing. It's real. It's real.
Really? Where do you keep it? Can you not say?
It's in my screening room.
Wow.
It's on the wall, right?
It's on the wall.
Yeah. Where? I mean, you know.
And when people broke in and stole stuff, they didn't steal that.
Good thing thieves are stupid, isn't
it's
it?
It's a good thing.
I would actually, if I had that, I would do what, I also said if I had won the Oscar, I'd do this as well. I would, every time someone's coming over, I'd have a chart of how tall people were.
Uh-huh.
Where do you keep yours, by the way?
Mantle in the den.
Oh, okay, all right. Because I found most people keep them in the bathroom. Have you
seen I've that? Heard this. I think a lot of this. I think a lot of this is.
I've seen a lot of Oscars.
Yeah,
I thought doorstops is what.
Yeah, that doorstop. The doorstop bathroom
is.
Thing.
Is you know, it's not. You know, they're not. It's like they're letting you know it's not important, but you are going to see it.
Right.
But I would find out. You know, how tall are you?
I'm 5'11".
Yeah, 5'11". I would have it hanging. Like Rosebud, I would adjustable. It would be at my front door, and I would have it hanging down to about 5'9". So when you walk in the door, it hits you in the head, and I go, "Oh, sorry, did my Oscar hit you in the head?" Oh, sorry, did Rosebud dent you? I'm so sorry. That's Rosebud, by the way.
I still suspect there's.
You can use that. If you want.
I will. Thank you. It makes party. I will do so. There's a lot of myth making, I think, around these things matter for people far more than we pretend. I always think of that hilarious story of the women who get photographed for the Vanity Fair Hollywood cover. Mm-hmm. They all tell the story of they send you one framed, right?
Right.
And you can't put that up. You just can't put that up. But what you can do is you can lean it against the floor,
right,
like in the living room, exactly, or in the kitchen, and just leave it there for a year and a half and say, "Oh, yeah, they sent that over. Yeah, it's a really nice photo.
She's
so pretty." And that's what everybody does. They sort of leave it laying around as if it just arrived yesterday, right?
Yeah.
So,
yep. So,
but, it, you know, you're not hanging it anymore.
Yeah.
Right?
But so, there is that. Yeah. No, now. Yeah. Yeah. It's true. Yeah. It's true. Yeah. Well, give us another one. Already have more? Or you knocks it out.
Gosh, another one. this is an embarrassing one.
Oh, good.
That's, you know, Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Sure.
Right? I was in a drama club, you know, in high school, which was really important for me in terms of seeing the craft I love and exercising the craft I love. And its ability to kind of bond us as just a suburban Texas drama club and starting in 1979, right? You know, that film, even though it's, you know,
dangerously close to a horror film.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Well, there's a parody. Are you Brad? Yeah. You were Brad, right?
Yeah. What does that mean?
Did you go to the
I would never.
Oh,
I would,
really?
We would sing the songs and we didn't really go and act out, you know, with throw the bread and all that. No, we didn't really do that. We'd go occasionally, but it was more just as, you know, on the drama bus, you know, in drama clubs back in the day. You would go to these dramatic and humorous and terp or one act competitions and buses and you'd sing. But it's just, I don't know, the ability of a film to sort of provide you with access to a subculture that you identified with,
yeah,
you know, and the, you know, and sort of, you know, and that playful relationship to transgression, you know, even though retrospect, it wasn't that transgressive, but you know, it just felt like so edgy and so calculated to offend everyone we knew. And it was delicious. I mean,
did you go to like midnight screenings?
We would, yeah. There was always every mall in the country, you know, and had a midnight screening. By 1980, took a while to catch on. I think probably a couple chains resisted or whatever, a couple malls resisted. But yeah, by 1980, there was always, you know, and it was, you know, it was nice. You'd go and you'd meet the kids from the other drama clubs in your town, you know, and, you know, you'd hang out and, you know, it'd be 100 of us and not a one of us claimed to be gay. It was so fascinating, right? You know, imagine, like, I'm sure in retrospect, many were, but it was just such a, you know, it's just such a, you know, such a nice way of building a subculture. I'm fascinated by the character of the small market hipster, right? That, you know, that kid that 10 years ago was like living in the Starbucks, you know, and there the one Starbucks by the Walmart in their small town, right? You know, and so, you know, we got to be small market hipsters, and there's a real power in that, right? That's where so many people who actually end up here doing things come from, right? It's because it's this other alternative identity that you're gonna escape the norms of your world, right?
Yeah.
So that was important for me biographically. Oh, is it good? Who the hell knows?
Is it possible to critique
that? That
Rocky Horror.
It's an event.
Yeah.
Is there somebody somewhere? I mean, it's out on. Is there a Blu-ray? There's probably a Blu-ray.
There's a Blu-ray. And that's one of the few Fox pictures that can now be seen.
Oh, they're letting
in repertory
out.
Disney has taken them all off the market.
Oh, really?
The one that they're letting them keep is Rocky Horror Picture.
Why are they?
Because I think they don't want the competition, or they don't want to be bothered, or it's somebody else's pictures, another studio, they don't give a shit. It's just become very difficult to see them in theaters.
Right.
That one is such a live event, though.
There's a theatrical version, I'm told now, that high schools perform.
Well, but it's based on the show.
This idea that 20 years, 30 years later, you know, that high school drama departments are putting on for the high school Rocky Horror, right?
Yeah.
It has a certain irony.
I grew up in Philadelphia, and Joe spent a lot of time there.
Right.
But the TLA was, if not, I don't think they were the first, they were one of the first to start those midnight shows.
Mm-hmm.
I was way too young at first, but there was something. You know, it looked really forbidden. I mean, imagine you're 7 years old and seeing Tim Curry and the thing. And it's like, it seemed really forbidden.
Josh, I had strong concerns about your parents.
No, I wouldn't go, but you would see the ads and things. Looked very, by the time I finally got to it, and you realize,
it's
benign and fun.
Yeah.
But it really had this, like, you know, as a child, I was like, are they probably not killing people on stage? Are they having sex on stage? What's going on there? It looks so squalid and scary. And you get to it, it's like,
You became a writer.
I became a writer. Yes. I've done Rocky once or twice. I came out with a golden underpants on.
Oh, right.
So that was, not my scene. I'm better off behind the camera. That's a wonderful experience. And it does. It also, like you say, it sort of brings you into the sort of communal aspect of both film and art and everything else.
Right. And camp stays with us for 20 years, right?
Yeah.
It's interesting. I mean, camp kicks in, you know, and it then.
And the things that are best remembered now.
Yep.
Are the campy things.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
Because although, they have a life.
Although my theory is that camp is always a modality, pretentious way of putting it, a modality of reception. You cannot create with camp. You can't make something camp, right? Camp requires the
sincerity.
The audience has an authentic relationship to it, where they are reappropriating it. They're repurposing it for their own needs.
But
right?
how do you explain? I mean, single greatest Batman of all time, I will brook no discussion, is obviously Adam West.
Okay,
and that show hit the ground. That was
right.
It got that.
Yeah, yeah.
It achieved that, but it started out with that intent.
Right,
And succeeded at it somehow.
Did it really? That's a really good question.
Yeah.
Was it clearly a camp intent, or was it more a comedic attempt that just sort of failed?
No, it was a campy intent that was based on the popularity of the 1943 Batman serial.
Right.
That was re-released to theaters
as
an entire evening of watching.
Interesting,
stuff.
And people responded to it.
And people responded to it because it was very funny and it was campy and it was very racist and very dated.
Right.
And all of the kids who saw this stuff thought, that's why my parents are like they are.
Oh my God. How did I not know this?
And that led to me making the movie Orgy, which is a very similar kind
of...
And also which depended on the idea that the stuff in it all had to be created with the sincerity, or else it wasn't funny. And then when, after we've been doing it for a while, the Schlitz beer people said, well, can't you get some more modern stuff in there, like The Man from U.N.C.L.E.? And it's like, well, you don't get it. The Man from U.N.C.L.E. is an intentional parody.
Right, yeah.
If you watch these movies from the 50s or 40s, they're funny because they are serious.
Right,
right.
And that they really never caught on to that. But the Batman TV show was... I had had all those Andy Warhol-ish kind of bang pow, cartoon panel things, and the opening. I remember what a big event the first episode of that was, and my disappointment was that when I watched the second episode, it was like, isn't this the same as the first episode?
Well, there's nowhere to go.
It was so innovative.
Right.
That the thought was, well, you know, if it's going to be like this, it's going to be innovative every week.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, think of how much fun it's going to be. And then it turned out, oh no, they found their groove. And this is it.
Oh, that's so interesting.
And the only thing that's going to be different on this show is the guest villains.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Which they managed to milk for, you know, God knows what, 3 years?
3 years. Yeah. But they, I mean, it's amazing when they just came out on Blu-ray last year, and I've been sort of holding off and going back to them until they looked
that production values will suffer in Blu-ray.
Amazing. No, you can't. You could just eat every episode.
Right, yeah.
But they hit the ground, right? He does the Batusi 10 minutes into the first episode. and I think Adam West got short shrift. I mean, he is a comic.
He's very, he's great timing.
Amazing.
He has dragged down
somewhat. But that's the old, that would be the one argument I'd have to make, because I think so many things become camp over time.
He's dragged down somewhat by Burt Ward.
Well, look, it becomes a matter of how you define parody and how you define camp, right? And you're probably right. I'll concede that.
But I would say, exception that may prove the rule.
It's hard. It is delicious to think about, though, these TV executives greenlighting this thing, right? And trying to think, this is for the kids.
Kids are going to like it.
Exactly. You know, and thinking it's for 14-year-olds when it's not.
I mean, I was a child, I thought it was just like, it was the quintessence. It was just a total badass
absolutely,
Batman.
Absolutely.
And then you come back to it as an adult.
Yeah. And it became this thing that everybody wanted to be on. It was a badge of honor to get to be on that show.
I think television had so much more profound influence on our taste than we realized.
Well, that's because when we were watching it, there was nothing else.
There was nothing else.
Now there's everything.
There's a unified field of culture.
Yeah, it was.
Everybody go to school on Monday morning and they say, did you see Twilight Zone?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you see Thriller? You know, and everybody's, we all saw it.
I have to go on Twitter now to find out that there's some new thing that the culture is talking about.
Right.
And I can track it down. If I can figure out what it really is.
That's just because you're too
old. And where it is. It's amazing.
But it was great to share that unified culture.
Yeah.
You know, it was.
And it'll never exist again.
It will never exist again.
Yeah.
There's something about that that's very moving to me, too.
What obviously. Can't not acknowledge that, it was a culture that was dominated by races that needed to have been broken down and all the rest of that. But there was that unity that at least provided a sense of solace that we were all in the same boat together. I just remember a moment, a couple decades ago, I was a comic book guy. And I remember there was just a moment when, I could walk into a comic book store and I didn't read every comic, but I was aware of all the comics.
Right. Yeah.
And I just remember going in one day and realizing I didn't know what half of these things were. That it just, things had exploded so much it was impossible now to be. Movies, the same thing.
You can't see everything.
But you never could see everything, but you could at least be aware of everything. Mm. And now I'm no fucking clue. Is your movie in theaters? Is it people? No, I'm kidding. Do I get it over my phone? How do I see this bombshell thing?
What is that again?
Is that from Korea?
Is that a podcast?
Yeah, exactly.
It was also interesting how not only was there this unified culture, there was a unified perception of where the culture was going, what felt like progress.
Right.
I think back on, because Charlie's Angels is out now when we're doing this, thinking about the original Charlie's Angels. Remember that Time magazine cover where they were all on Time?
Oh, right.
They put together. And you could, and And the fact that you could see Farrah Fawcett's nipples sort of through the, you know.
Well, that was the one that she was on by herself.
It was that one that she was,
Believe me. I know what you're talking
about. But in general, and that was this version of both objectification and liberation at the same time.
Yeah.
And it's weird, messed up way. But it felt like we were all part of this exciting progress that, you know, with all these things are moving forward, and my God, we're moving towards the 21st century, and
it's going to be like the Jetsons.
It's going to be like the Jetsons. We're going to have flying
cars.
Flying cars.
You know, and now we have Peter Thiel complaining about there's no flying cars.
We got drones.
Yeah. Well, I always felt the problem with flying cars is that they would crash. There'd be an awful lot of
people. Yeah, I don't want my neighbors flying. Hell no.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. If
you could imagine LA traffic and just move it up into the sky.
Yeah, now it's three-dimensional.
You wouldn't be able to see the sun.
Yeah, right. Like to see a Freebie the Bee where it just drives into their fourth-floor bedroom.
Exactly.
Yes.
You got two Freebie and the Bean mentions in here.
Yeah, that's pretty good. I'm working them. They pay me. It's part of our new sponsorship. Charles, are you? That was lovely.
Sitting around. Great.
Yeah. Thank you for hanging out with me.
Thank you for coming on. Wonderful. You did not even remotely embarrass yourself.
Okay.
You
good.
Embarrassed me. My Czech New Wave awareness. I'm good on German New Wave.
Yeah.
French New Wave. I've seen my list.
You will like the tone of Czech better. I'm going to argue.
Yeah.
He's working on his Sri Lankan at the moment.
I see.
Yes. Okay.
It's because it has that thing that we've now embraced, which is that sort of Cohen-esque tone of sort of knowingness, right? That just is on the edge of humor, of parody, but not quite.
And also reacting to repressiveness.
And exactly. Yeah.
Which is always more fun than freedom.
Than being repressed?
Yeah. not a particularly brilliant statement, but, any kind of oppression applied to an artist, is I think a good thing.
This is Milosz's thing. Milosz's whole thing is what the censor gives you is tells you exactly what to write about.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
And the censor the great thing about censorship is it tells you exactly where you need to go.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause the whole point is to get past it.
Yeah.
And kick them in the ass because you are smarter than them. Isn't that how you finally? Yeah. Yes.
Well, and that's your job. I mean, that's your job as a movie filmmaker or artist, however you want to call it, right? Is to push those buttons. What for our culture, I think, is so interesting right now is the most transgressive space we can be in is the middle. How crazy is that, right? You know what I mean? Like, it's like we're so partisan that rooting around in the middle is sort of where. Where the subversive stuff is, right.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, thank you for coming on. Thanks for sitting around and making us all feel old. we'll talk about Walter Cronkite next. No, thank you very much.
And, guys, thank you for
huge luck and congratulations with Bombshell. Can't wait. Can't wait to see it.
I look forward to seeing it.
I'm not concerned. Yeah. That's not what I'm going in anxiously.
Good.
although I don't know, big risk with those actresses. That's,
yeah, you never know. You never know.
Anyway,
thanks guys.
Yes. Our show was recorded in beautiful downtown Burbank. The official podcast of TrailersFromHell.com, the best damn movie website there is. Our engineer is the composer Don Barrett, who also transmogrified, produced, and created our theme song. This is Josh Olson for The Movies That Made Me.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.